This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
I've often said to colleagues that if I want to get a lot of mail, and usually nasty mail, I need to do a story on either vaccines or Lyme disease. So today, let's go for broke. You may not remember this, but there is a vaccine for Lyme disease. The catch? No one makes it anymore.
Lyme disease is the only infection that I know of for which we have a safe and effective vaccine, but it's not available to the public.
On today's Health Show, the story of the vaccine your dog can get, but you can't.
We'll also hear about a report on drug laws in New York State, and we'll talk to a man who bid a melancholy farewell to his prostate. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Lyme disease has been around for a long time, at least 5,300 years. DNA tests show that the Iceman found frozen in a glacier in the Alps had the Lyme disease bacteria. The good news is that modern science has given us a vaccine that gives us immunity against the tick-borne disease. The bad news? We don't use it. Kurt Nickisch has the story of the vaccine that society left on the shelf.
11-year-old Ned Kelly is in for his annual physical at a clinic in Boston's Jamaica Plain neighborhood. As part of his checkup, he's getting a booster shot to protect him against Lyme disease. Ned doesn't like needles, but he holds still while Dr. Joel K. squeezes the pink serum under his skin.
You're a good boy. A little pinch. We'll be home free. All right, good job. Done. All right, handsome.
Ned is lucky because he's one of the select few who can get the vaccine that gives him immunity against Lyme disease. Ned is lucky because he's a dog. We're at the MSPCA Angel Animal Medical Center, where dogs are regularly vaccinated against Lyme. Ned, the dog's owner, Joe Turchin, lives in Falmouth. Ticks are bad there, and Lyme is prevalent. He's glad he can protect his dog, but he wishes there were a human vaccine, too.
You know, if there were a vaccine, our doctors would be suggesting it to us, certainly for those of us who live on the Cape and the islands, because it's a horrendous plague.
That's when I told Turchin that there is a Lyme vaccine for people. It's just that no one makes it anymore.
Why not?
Why not? The answer might depress you.
Lyme disease is the only infection that I know of for which we have a safe and effective vaccine, but it's not available to the public.
To find out why it's not available, I talked to Alan Steer. He's the physician who discovered Lyme disease. Steer was 33 years old back in 1975 when he was sent to the Connecticut town of Lyme to look into a mysterious cluster of kids who'd gotten arthritis.
4 or 5 months into the investigation, we came to suspect that ticks may be involved.
Steer's team had found a previously unknown disease, and ever since, Lyme has been his life's work. After the discovery, he and other scientists first isolated the spiral-shaped bacterium that causes Lyme disease, and then found ways to make people immune to it. Today, Steer's laboratory is at Massachusetts General Hospital. He says finding a biological pathway to vaccinate against Lyme was a major milestone.
Lyme disease was epidemic in certain locations, particularly in the northeastern United States. So here was the possibility of really changing that.
By the mid-1990s, two pharmaceutical companies began trials of candidate vaccines. Gregory Poland is a vaccinologist at the Mayo Clinic. He says the vaccines helped people build up lots of antibodies.
So that when a tick bites you and sucks your blood, it is sucking up the antibodies out of your blood. Those antibodies go into the tick's gut, kill the Lyme organisms that are there. So when that tick then regurgitates into your skin, you don't get Lyme disease.
Poland says as innovative as these vaccines were for killing the Lyme bacterium before it even got into your body, they weren't perfect. You had to get booster shots, so it took a year to become immune. It wasn't approved for children 14 and under. Still, for those 15 and above, it worked pretty well. Human trials conducted by Alan Steer showed that more than 80% of those vaccinated gained immunity. Introduced in 1998, the vaccine sold well at first, but then opponents spoke out, self-described vaccine victims, similar to people today who claim vaccines cause autism. Back then, they said that the Lyme vaccine gave them arthritis. Vaccinologist Gregory Poland.
And this sort of got into popular lore. It spread on the internet. There were a number of East Coast lawyers who started putting together class action lawsuits. There were anti-vaccine advocacy groups.
And there were threats against the scientists who had worked to help protect people. Alan Steer got a security detail. Now, the clinical data did not back up any of this. The trials had not shown such side effects. The FDA and CDC looked into the claims and recommended people continue getting the vaccine. But it was too late. Sales had plummeted. 4 years after offering people immunity against Lyme, SmithKline Beecham stopped making the vaccine. The second vaccine maker, Pasteur Mario Cannot, saw what had happened and never put out its own product. Gregory Poland says since then, Lyme has spread, becoming the most common tick-borne disease in the country.
Now, with the withdrawal of the vaccine, people are doing all kinds of things. I'm personally aware of individuals who, in desperation, have gone to veterinarians and remarkably convinced the veterinarian to inject them with the canine vaccine.
Despite the growing demand to have access to a human vaccine, many drug companies say they're not interested in working on one.
Well, I think there are so many diseases.
Farshad Girahu is an R&D director at Sanofi Pasteur, the vaccines division of the drug giant Sanofi. His company is working instead on a vaccine for dengue fever.
For diseases like Lyme disease, the medical need is smaller. So when we need to put our resources, we obviously have to put where the medical need is greater, and then you can make the vaccine.
With little to no interest from drug companies, some people want government to step in, even state government. At a hearing of the new Massachusetts Lyme Disease Commission, veterinarian Sam Telford suggested the state of Massachusetts license GlaxoSmithKline's FDA-approved vaccine.
We all know that the market has changed. People are fed up. I mean, this is a terrible situation we're in, which means that a vaccine still makes sense.
Telford says the state could make it at the UMass Biologics Laboratory in Jamaica Plain, which has made other vaccines before. GlaxoSmithKline would not say whether it would consider such an option. So for now, there's no sign of any vaccine becoming available. And if there were, Mayo Clinic vaccinologist Gregory Poland says the old opponents are already promising to fight the introduction of any new Lyme vaccine.
So we know scientifically how to develop a vaccine that would protect against all this human misery. And yet, for these sort of societal or cultural reasons, not scientific reasons, that will not be done in the foreseeable future in the U.S.
Alan Steer is a little more hopeful. The man who first connected the mysterious affliction to the ticks of Lyme, Connecticut, back in 1975, has worked on the disease his entire professional life. Losing the human vaccine that he had helped along, he admits, was a major setback.
Multiple things happened. What I'd like to see happen now is that it's possible to move on, even make a better vaccine. I think that's still possible.
Until that day, people are going to have to try to protect themselves. Long pants, insecticides, body inspections. People are going to have to keep living with Lyme. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch.
A report released recently offers recommendations that its authors believe could make New York State a national model by shifting drug policy from a criminalization-based to a public health-based approach. The Health Show's Dave Lucas reports.
The New York Academy of Medicine and the Drug Policy Alliance have released a joint report entitled Blueprint for a Public Health and Safety Approach to Drug Policy, almost 40 years to the day after Governor Nelson Rockefeller signed his eponymous drug laws. A lock-them-up-and-throw-away-the-key approach that was adopted nationwide in the ensuing decades, leading the U.S. to incarcerate more of its own citizens than any other country in the world. The report suggests suggests a more equitable, cost-effective, and evidence-based approach to drug law enforcement. Gabriel Saya, New York State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, says it's time New York moved in that direction.
Where we could go from having some of the worst drug laws in the country to some of the best drug laws in the country, to go from a criminalization approach to an approach guided by science, guided by the evidence and guided by community input.
Saya says the report reveals that race and place matter.
That when looking at our drug policies, we can learn a lot about the impact of those policies and the impact and the health impacts of drug use and other health issues by looking at place. And when the map or the report includes many maps that show areas where there's both a high concentration of poverty, a high concentration of incarceration, and also happen to be concentrated areas where people of color live. And we found this throughout the state, that these were, place and race are very important, and that they're integral in trying to attempt to address our drug policies and to effectuate more effective approaches.
A detailed list of recommendations for action includes
the need for a cross-agency and cross-sectoral leadership structure here in the state that brings together multiple parties so that we can assess where we currently are together and identify solutions moving forward.
Dr. Ruth Finkelstein, Senior Vice President for Policy and Planning at the New York Academy of Medicine, says that when people are seeking drug treatment, they encounter sanctions and difficulties, underscoring the need for a socially supportive recovery system.
We need no door to be the wrong door for a drug user in search of treatment.
Finkelstein adds current policy turns drug users into high-cost users of multiple systems. Albany County District Attorney David Soares says the criminal justice system is not designed to provide health care.
Our doors are the only doors that remain open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and so access to treatment more often in some communities are obtained through the criminal justice system, which is unfortunate because removing the stain of the act that presented them in the criminal justice system can sometimes be difficult, and the collateral damages of those convictions cannot be so easily erased.
Sean Bushway, a professor of criminal justice at UAlbany, says the report acknowledges that New York probably has the most extensive set of drug treatment options available for people both inside and out of the criminal justice system of any place in the country.
But suggest that we potentially could do more, which seems like a reasonable statement. That's always true. And they're asking for a conversation about ways to do more. That seems reasonable. I think the problem will be the devil's in the details in terms of exactly what we should do and at what cost.
Marijuana has been decriminalized since 1977. The report says a loophole allows police to arrest tens of thousands every year, mostly young people of color. It calls on Governor Andrew Cuomo to convene policymakers and agency officials across sectors to coordinate implementation of a unified approach to drug policy and fix what it calls New York's broken marijuana possession law. It is unclear how law enforcement will react to the report. Several law enforcement agencies contacted, including the DEA, declined comment until they have time to examine the document. I'm Dave Lucas.
Still to come, prostate cancer is no laughing matter, but one author has given it a good try. We'll talk to him next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1311.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Jamie McKenzie's life was turned upside down a few years ago when he was diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer. Given several choices of treatment, he opted to have his prostate removed and has since turned the experience into an entertaining but still scary for a middle-aged man book called Saying Goodbye to Your Prostate, a decidedly outside-the-box journal on how to beat prostate cancer and laugh while doing it. I spoke with Jamie McKenzie recently, and I started by asking the obvious question. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. Thank you for asking. I'm doing terrific. Well, now it's every 6 months I get a PSA draw, a blood draw, and everything is undetectable, so I'm very, very grateful.
Now, we know how you came to this topic. When did you say, you know what, this will make a good book?
Well, let's see. I had my surgery almost 2 years ago, so I had no intention of doing it. But I was talking with a friend and recounting here and there certain things that I recalled happening over the journey. And invariably, ones would come up that were double entendres or humorous anecdotes. And he finally put the phone down and said, "Brother, you've got a riff on this. Men need this. Women need this."
Every step of the way you took, you did what doctors pray people will do. You took people with you to appointments. How helpful was that to you?
Oh, it was critical. A doctor friend up here recommended that. He said, you need a second, everybody needs a second or third pair of ears, because it's just human nature that in the stress of the moment and trying to take in the information, you're not going to be able to process it all and remember it, no matter how many notes you take. So I also remember Carly Simon, the singer-songwriter. When she was diagnosed, she said the first thing she did was get as many warriors around her as possible. And I think that stuck in my mind, so I said, I want at least, you know, like the Ark, two of every kind with me in these appointments. And everybody will be right there for you, but you have to reach out and ask them for help. And so many of us don't want to bother someone or impose, but you have to ask for help.
Step by step, this is like a 4 or 5 step process that you went through. And the first was just actually making the decision to get a biopsy, which to me is kind of the toughest decision, because then you know you're opening the door and here you go.
Yep.
How tough was it for you to make that decision?
It was, you know, I'm a Pisces, so it probably was very tough and then maybe very easy. Once my doctor had told me, your PSA levels have risen over the last 2 years, I'd like you to see a urologist. It's probably nothing. It may be chronic prostatitis, but get it checked out. So I was, of course, thinking, of course, it was not disease at all, and I would take something for it and get on with it. When the urologist in New York City, because I live in Connecticut, but I went back to the big city to see a very well-recommended guy there, he said, make sure you get the PSA numbers, the results, broken down into free versus bound. And those are two critical words. The PSA test has been criticized. It's not perfect. It saved my life. But the most helpful it can be is the numbers need to be broken down into free versus bound. If they are in parity, it's very likely there's no disease. If they are skewed, as mine were, 17 to 83% or something like that, then they really strongly recommend a biopsy. Once he said those numbers and the skewed proportions.
And yours were really skewed.
And mine were skewed, yeah.
Yes.
And that's where the test really shines, actually. If it's just number to number, year to year, man to man, it can be very flexible. But once they have that, they have a very, very good cue that there is disease present. So I guess as soon as I knew that, I knew I was in for it, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, let's get on with it and get results as quickly as possible and take whatever steps we need to take.
And a lot of your book is talking about waiting. You do an awful lot of waiting when you're waiting for the results of these tests. You're waiting for the day of you know, your biopsy and eventually your surgery. And again, that's where friends seem to help so much.
You bet. There's a lot of waiting. And of course, the perception of time gets completely altered because of your focus and the stress. You know, I couldn't get the surgery date quick enough, but you have to wait for healing after the biopsy and you have to wait for schedules. And you just had to keep, talking to everybody I could all the time. I didn't do a lot of reading on the subject, which is ironically, which I guess is why I wrote this book in many ways, the format of which in my book is very like a children's book almost. It has very large type, as you know. It's got cartoons heading every chapter. It's got cartoon drawings on the front, very comical. And at every step of the way, I wanted to make a terrifying journey reassuring, comfortable, knowing you can mine humor out of great stress and trauma. And I recall that at the time of my biopsy results, there were many, many, many wonderful books on the market, on the shelf, but they were dry and doctorly, and they felt like an additional punishment to have to read.
Well, going to the end, I guess what most men are going to be really interested in is, you know, how you're doing after the surgery. What kind of after effects are you having?
Oh, of course, of course. And there's there are a couple of chapters in the book, of course, about that. It differs for all men. I just spoke to a colleague who went through the surgery about 3 weeks ago, and his continence came back within about 2.5-3 weeks. Mine took about 6, I guess. It's different for everybody, but I was very pleased that he had said at work with his company, he's never used the word erection so many times in conversation in his life. And we laughed, and I said, I understand. And he said, but suddenly I can talk about all this. And when I talk to employees and colleagues at work, they feel more comfortable in talking about the subject too, which is a huge stumbling block to get past, because men, unlike women, we tend to hide too much and go into denial so much more easily, whereas women are smarter and, you know, face it and move forward. So it's been great to talk about results with people who call me saying, boy, I'm facing this, or my father, or my uncle, my nephew, whatever. And the results, as I said, are different for everyone. That for me, the issue of continence was more frightening or more frustrating than loss of erection, frankly. And for all men, erection function comes back. It can come back very quickly. It can come back on average a year or so. With most, it comes back and resumes to where you were by 2 years. And there are treatments along the way, post-surgery treatments, to affect the circulation for your erection and for just that whole part of your body.
Well, let's hope that you don't have to write a sequel to this.
Well, I hope so. And again, what's very important is that, you know, people, I was not aware until the book was put to bed that men get prostate cancer 33% more than women get breast cancer. So if you have a stadium with 300 women on one side, you have to have 400 men across. And yet it's 97% curable and treatable, but it has to be detected early. And as I say to everyone, the overarching message of the book is you can't wait till 50, as we used to say, to begin testing. It's got to begin at 35. There was a 38-year-old in my surgery group. It's hitting younger and younger, but caught early, it is the most treatable. As my friend Tom, who suggested I start writing a book at some point, when I was first got the biopsy results, I, you know, froze, went numb, started crying, called my two best friends, and Ed was very empathetic and quiet and supportive, and I called Tom, and Tom, within 10 seconds, had me laughing. Why? Because he said to me, brother, we're all going to get cancer. This is the one you want.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me bust out laughing, which was amazing, but it was so true, and it is so true.
I think you called it the measles of middle-aged men.
It is, and that's what I've been told. You know, many people say this is just the middle-aged man's measles. So, but it's got to be caught early. I lost my best friend from childhood last October because he woke up at 47 with it. So the agony is that had the recommendation 15 years ago been start testing earlier, he'd probably still be here.
Again, the name of Jamie McKenzie's book is Saying Goodbye to Your Prostate, a decidedly outside-the-box journal on how to beat prostate cancer and laugh while doing it. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.